What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of After the Closing. My name is Sam RP. I'm a realtor here in Boston, and this is my podcast. Mark Savatsky is the guest today. He is from Choose Boston, which is his own development company. He also has a podcast called The Real Estate Addicts, where he talks about development and construction and that whole process. Mark is a local developer here in Boston, so that is what our discussion is about. It's his journey getting into developing real estate and working with other realtors and what that's like, what he looks for on deals. And I think it's a good conversation. Look, I'm not going to lie. I was a little out of my league talking to Mark. This dude knows everything. But I think you guys are going to enjoy it. So here is my conversation with Mark Savatsky. You're one of the first guests, sure. So welcome. But the idea is finding different angles with each guest that our audience can get kind of a different perspective. Nice. So it's mostly going to be agent facing.
Sure.
But the reason why I wanted to have you on was because your attention to detail and your respect for your craft, I think, is rare. And I like the craft, and I wish I could build. I think I can build things. Mm-hmm. And my wife, it's, I think, one of the biggest pet peeves that my wife has of me. I will take an idea, and then 2 hours later, I'm at Home Depot, spend a couple $100, come home, try to put it together. Yeah. 2 hours later, I'm like, I have no idea what I'm doing. And it just, I throw it away.
Well, don't be too hard on yourself. I'm not the craftiest person with a hammer either. But, you know, as far as managing a process and being sort of the general contractor, the conductor of the band, that's just something that comes with time.
Yeah.
And I always tell people, you know, just, you know, crawl, walk, run, and don't bite off more than you can chew. And I think you'll be fine. You'll obviously learn some things along the way. But the goal is for any of those lessons, be modest enough as you go that they don't, you know, sink your ship or knock you down. And, you know, my other favorite saying is you got to pay for your education.
So you went right into college with the idea that you wanted to build. I know that you went in for construction management. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I spent my freshman year at like a small liberal arts school in Schenectady, New York, Union College.
Is that where you're from?
No, I grew up in North Jersey.
Oh, okay.
But
Where in Jersey?
Bergen County, like outside New York.
Okay. Yeah, what town?
Saddle River.
Okay. My wife's from Glen Rock.
Oh yeah, for sure. Big rivals. But
I only know because everyone in Jersey goes by county.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've never heard anyone say that, but every time we go and someone's like, oh, I'm from Jersey. She goes, oh yeah, I'm from Bergen County. Where are you from?
It's like a weird amount of New Jersey pride out there. It's like everybody shits on New Jersey. So people from New Jersey, like
love
really,
it.
Really? Yeah.
Love it. Hardcore.
Yeah. Some kids I went to high school with, I'm not going to call them close friends, but have like our area code tattooed somewhere on their body.
I'm from Maine. I get it.
You get it.
I get it.
Yeah. Not all of Jersey stinks. I just want to put that out there. some nice parts of Jersey.
So you go to upstate New York.
Upstate New York. Yeah. I'm studying economics. I actually thought that I was going to do civil engineering, but they apparently dropped the program the year before I started. So I audibled and I was doing the whole like Wall Street prep thing and I just hated it.
Yeah.
And I was working for a family friend in the summer in Connecticut, framing houses. He was a custom home builder he was just doing awesome stuff. And he was good enough to give me an opportunity. So I worked for him for 2 summers, kind of worked my way up and, decided like, this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
And
that was your first entrance into construction, was that job?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, definitely the old start pushing a broom and then they gave me a skill saw and helped with some of the framing. And, I mean, one of the coolest things about being a builder is really like, what's your biggest asset in your entire life?
Yeah. Your home.
Your home.
Yeah.
You know, and so I can build my own home. I can live in a home for, I'd say 30% less than the next person.
Yeah.
You know, by GC building and all myself. And, so I've been fortunate. Like I would say I haven't had a housing cost since I was like 25 years old.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's the dream.
Exactly right.
So you go and then you transition did you change colleges at that point?
Yeah. So I was like, you know, it's kind of felt like the walls were closing in a little bit.
Yeah.
This small 2,000-3,000 kid college I thought I wanted,
but then once
I was there, yeah, it's not that small, but it kind of felt like high school. So I went totally to the other extreme. I went to Purdue.
Yeah.
So Big Ten, 40,000 kids, big university, and I studied construction management, construction engineering.
And then what brought you to Boston?
Funny enough, Suffolk Construction was just recruiting at a job fair.
Yeah.
And they had a really cool program called a Career Start. And they flew me out to Boston. I think I met with John.
They flew you out.
Yeah, they flew me out. I mean, you know, good I was a them. Very desirable candidate, I'm sure. anyway, they were probably looking for someone with very mediocre lacrosse skills.
Yeah.
Who was kind of fast but had no endurance. So I don't know. I joke. So I came out to Boston and I was like, this is cool. So, did 5 or 6 years at Suffolk.
Yeah.
And
what were you doing for them?
You know, I did a little of everything. So I started out, project management.
Yeah.
And then spent 2 years in the field as an assistant superintendent. And yeah. then really sort of spent my most time in pre-construction and estimating. And that was very much by design. I always feel like you can do anything with time or money. And that's the most important variable on a spreadsheet. So I wanted to really understand construction costs and estimating.
And was that partly because you knew that you wanted to start to develop your own projects?
Yeah, at some point that was always sort of the goal. You know, I think real estate is my business and construction is my trade.
Yeah.
And it's easy enough to spin a spreadsheet if you just plug in any assumptions you want, but you know, what those assumptions are and how you inform them is everything.
Right. And then, so you go from Suffolk and you went to another company from Suffolk, but around the same time you started your own,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly right. So I was at Suffolk. I was buying single families in South Boston
yeah.
when you could do things like that
yeah.
And renovating
those
them.
Those were the days.
Those were the days. It's amazing. I'd renovate them. I would skip out at lunch. I'd come back and my boss would be like, why is there fucking dirt? It was, you know, the uniform at the time was white shirt and tie.
Really?
He'd be like, yeah. Like, why are you tucking your shirt? You're a goddamn mess.
So you're doing them at the same time.
Yeah, it was. And it was, they were small. They were single families, but I was bootstrapping it. Yeah.
Were you by yourself at the time?
Yes, yeah. Very much so.
Was this Choose Boston?
Yeah, this was like the start of Choose Boston, certainly the advent. And I was fortunate enough to be able to sort of renovate those homes, move into them, bring in a couple roommates, and then call the bank through and do, you know, the BRRRR, buy, yeah. renovate, rehab, refinance rather.
Sure.
And so the bank would come through, I would get a cash out refi, and I was able to roll that into another property. And I did that a couple times, and certainly the tide in the environment kept rising. One of the things that drew me to Boston was the notion that like you didn't need billions of dollars to start. Like Manhattan was my other option, my right. likely scenario. And I thought that if you want to be a real estate developer in New York, you better have a trust fund.
And it's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
I mean, but I think that those are important. Like the stories that we tell ourselves can be limiting.
Yeah.
So like you say that in Boston, it's harder than ever, but you know, maybe the play then is to buy something in Everett
yeah.
or to look in Lynn. I think there's a lot of opportunity in those places, but buy something with 3 bedrooms, be fortunate enough to be at a point in your life when you can have roommates and you yeah. don't have...
This is the single life.
Yeah, this is the single yeah. life. And there are some golden years where that's possible.
So you're doing that, you're in your mid-20s.
Mid-20s.
What's the first one that you got?
Single family for $275,000.
In Southie?
In Southie.
That's awesome.
Yeah, shout out to Joyce Lebedew, who helped me acquire that.
And what was the... Where did you see the opportunity in that one? Was that one that you said, okay, I can, was it just broken down and you were just going to improve it? Or were you adding bedrooms, adding square footage? What was your-
It was broken down. It was yeah. Definitely in need of a lot of repair. And it had 3 bedrooms.
Yep.
And it was in a good location in Southie. And it was the cheapest thing I could find.
Yeah.
So that was sort of my investment thesis early on, was just buy stuff that's really inexpensive. Because how bad could it get? This is the least expensive thing on the market. And that worked pretty well.
Did it go the way that you had hoped? Or were there hiccups along the way that you were just completely unprepared for?
Yeah, definitely hiccups. I hired my electrician off of Craigslist.
You know, I hear Craigslist is where you get your best
yeah,
hires.
Yeah, especially skilled trades like electrical. That's really where you want to look. But you know, tight budgets. And so I just remember like going to the house one day after work and there was no power anywhere. And it wasn't something that was planned. I was like trying every outlet, hitting every switch, going to the breaker. And I thought for sure, like everything was screwed and I needed all new electric. And you know, I promise God, if you get me through this, I'll never do another renovation again.
But you managed
yeah,
it.
Yeah, managed it. Ended up firing that electrician.
Oh, you didn't use him again, huh?
No. So that was the first one. I actually still have that property and
yeah.
I still rent that. It's awesome.
that must be cash flowing heavily now.
Yeah, I tell you that rent is like almost $4,000 a month.
Yeah. And you bought it for what, 250?
Yeah, 275.
Yeah.
I think I spent $70,000 on a renovation.
Wow, that's awesome. Yeah. And are you, for that property, were you doing a lot of the legwork with the renovation?
We did the demo ourselves.
Yeah.
I had a couple friends.
That's easy.
Yeah.
That
was kind of fun.
Yeah.
But really didn't, I didn't tile. I didn't do any, you know, installing kitchen cabinets or anything like that.
Yeah.
Pretty much hired out most of that.
And were any of the people that you were hiring coworkers of yours at Suffolk?
No, I mean, it's definitely a different subcontractor pool.
Yeah.
I had, I think my a tile guy from Suffolk gave me a bunch of extra inventory of some awful almond colored Subway tile that's still in around the bathroom.
That won't date at all.
No whatsoever. I can't imagine why he had so much extra.
Yeah. Always go with a tile that's just, you got it sitting around your basement. Yeah. That's the perfect look that you're looking for.
Yeah, for sure.
And were you nervous when you first made that first purchase? Was that like, I mean, that's a big decision. Obviously you looked at the numbers ahead of time, but taking that leap, I know for a lot of people it's a big risk. And sometimes you're like, you know, it's a fuck it moment. Let's go in. Let's see what happens here.
Yeah, it definitely was. I mean, part of the logic was like, what do I have to lose?
Yeah. Your money.
Yeah, your money. And I guess I think it's important to acknowledge like a couple things. I think it's the idea of like, so where did you get the capital to start? I was fortunate enough, my grandfather had left me $100,000 when he had passed away. Me and I used every bit of that on that house.
Yeah.
And I'd say that like, I knew that if I really got down to it or things got bad, I always had a safety net. I could, you know, my folks would probably be willing, well, they would be willing to help me out if I needed it. I've had a lot of pride and I never wanted to get there. And I think I avoided that.
Were they cool with you doing this? Did they know you were doing it?
Very encouraging.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, definitely. So I don't think there was ever like a master plan at the outset though. You know, things sort of evolve and you finish the first one and the bank comes through and you see the appraiser like, that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll
and
do
it
this.
Out.
Yeah, exactly right. And it's the same thing for the first time I did a new construction project, tear down a house, you know, go through the zoning process. But I didn't have family deep roots in Boston. I wasn't like super connected. I didn't have an uncle to call who could straighten something out for me.
So you were hustling alone.
Yeah. I mean, the closest thing I had really was that network at Suffolk Construction because there were some guys there who I'm still grateful, like on the executives on the fifth floor, a few guys in particular who I could go to and, you know, ask for help navigating something.
So you finish the Southie project.
Yep.
It works. You get money out of it.
Yep.
You go to do another one. Is it another single family?
Yeah. So it's a semi-attached single family, right?
Yep.
So it's two of them. They're absolutely identical, but mirror images.
Mm-hmm.
They're side by side. And there's a doctor from Brookline who owned the identical single family on the other side of the firewall or the party wall.
Mm-hmm.
And I had reached out to him one day and said like, you know, Ben, if Dr. Markham, if you're ever thinking of selling, you know, please reach out to me, let me know. And one day he emailed me and he's like, I'm considering it. Would you like to make an offer?
Is this the other half of the one that you already owned?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So I felt like I already had the recipe.
You know? So you just copied it.
Copy paste.
Yeah.
I paid him the market I'd appreciate. I gave him $330 for that one.
And what year is this? When is this?
This is 2000.
Pre-crash?
No, it's post-crash.
Yeah.
I started right in the crash.
Yeah.
Yeah. A bunch of kids from my program were getting job opportunities rescinded and stuff between, you know, interview and graduation. It was a weird time.
Jeez. Yeah.
When did you graduate?
2010.
2010. Yeah.
So I got into this in 2011. So you get the neighboring property,
mm-hmm.
and then you do the same thing. Works out?
I move into it. So shortest move of all times. I took my couch down the stairs and up the stairs on the other side.
Yeah.
No hiring of movers. And I rented out the first place and became a landlord for the first time.
Yeah.
And so I did that, did it again, started.
Did you fix any of those kinks that you had in the first one? You had a new electrician.
Yeah. Yeah, new electrician. Yeah. Did not use Craigslist. I still was. There's a post office across the street. And at the time, they gave these moving packets. You know, when you move and the USPS sends you like Bed Bath & Beyond.
Do they still do that? And
they do, but they're just smarter about it now.
I remember when we moved in here, it was thick.
Yeah.
It was just so much crap.
Yeah. And it's a bunch of stuff like, you know, DirecTV and things you don't need. But one of the coupons in there at the time was a 10% off Home Depot coupon.
There you go. Use it.
Yeah.
Was there a cap on it?
Yeah, there was. And I just remember going to the post office like once a week and made friends. I was like, can I have another stack of those moving, they're envelopes? Like, sure. They're like, yeah, what are you doing?
Was it right across from the post office there?
Yeah, right across. Exactly.
Yeah.
So that was like my little secret, 10% off everything.
And that one works out again.
And so I did it again. And then actually started looking at East Boston.
Yeah.
So East Boston at the time, I was working at Suffolk and there was a really large group, developing what's now Portside.
Yeah.
East Pier.
The rental building
yep. Right on the waterfront. And I was like, I went out to meet some guys who actually do piles for foundations because they were going to renovate that wharf and build on the wharf. And I'm looking at the renderings. I'm like, this is incredible. You're going to build this here and I could buy a 3-family for that. It's like, I'm just going to follow you guys. So
yeah.
I bought a bank-owned 2-family for $300,000.
Okay.
And I renovated that.
And did you go condos with that?
You know, I didn't at first. I lived in one of the units. And I rented out the other unit. And then when I finally moved, I did flip those, convert those into condominiums. And
that was your first, experience condoizing?
That was my first condominium conversion. Yeah.
Yeah. And was that a lesson learned doing that? I mean, it's pretty straightforward. I feel like, you know, you have the attorney just do all the paperwork. Did you change your approach at all with that?
No, that was fairly easy. If you have a decent attorney, yeah. I feel like they can guide you through that process. There's some people think that it requires some sort of permit or special provision from the building department. A 2-family as a multifamily dwelling or as 2 condominiums is completely independent of any permitting concerns or things that the city might care about from the building department. But what I did learn there was the Zoning Board of Appeals and how variances worked.
Yeah.
I'm sure
that was fun.
That was fun. That was scary. that was another moment where it was like, if I get through this, I'll never do it again. But no, I purchased a store and a residential unit, whereas I thought I was purchasing 2 residential units, like a 2-family. And I came to learn that the hard way. I went to apply for my permit and they're like, no, you need a change of use. This is not a 2-family. What you bought is a store. And I'm like, I assure you it isn't a store. I come over and they're like, okay, we'll file a long
doesn't
form.
Matter.
Yeah.
So, on paper.
Yeah. So I got cited for a few variances and figured while I'm renovating it and getting variances, get the roof deck one too. And
explain to the people who are listening if they don't know what a variance is.
Yeah. So there's an underlying set of codes. There's building code and there's zoning code.
Yep.
So zoning provisions might be the maximum height of a building, your rear yard setback, the maximum floor area ratio or open space.
Right.
But nonetheless, so that code was written in Boston in the 60s and typically nothing built today complies with this fairly arcane code. So you need to go through this community process.
And it's slow.
It's slow. It's definitely time consuming. And then that process culminates in an appearance before the zoning board.
Yeah.
And they ultimately will vote on the approval or not of your variances, which are exceptions to that zoning code.
And the step-by-step process is you first get what the abutters involved, right? They have to come in and you have to pitch it to them. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, your first step is really to submit 4 permits to the city and a plans examiner from the building department will review your plans and quickly tell you, issue you what's called a refusal letter. And in that letter, it'll say like, you're not getting a permit, Sam, and here's why. You have excessive height and insufficient rear yard setback. And you know, seek relief for these things and then come back and see me.
And you have to have an attorney to help you out there, right? Have you ever seen people do it without the attorney involved?
I did it my first time.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. You don't, that's a little bit of a misnomer. Huh. I think it takes a little bit more, perseverance.
So this is how you learned everything.
Yeah.
Just you were like, you were in it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. The city also has this like Thursday night zoning board, which is for like 1, 2, or 3 family dwellings. It's really intended to capture people just like myself at the time who are not national development or building a $40 million multifamily something. But so it's somewhat user-friendly. And I think the community group in East Boston at the time took mercy on me. I think they saw what the stress and anxiety.
So you get through that.
Yeah.
And from there, was your first ground up development in East Boston too, right?
It was, yeah.
And how far after this 2-family experience did you go into that one?
Probably 2 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And are you doing a couple other multifamilies in between?
No, I'm sort of like one or two, really one project at a time for the most part. When I do a project, I am the general contractor. I often will sell the product myself unless someone brings it to me, in which case I'll usually, give that same person the sales on the back end.
And did you sell the one in East Boston, your ground up? Was that one that you did all on your own?
I did do the sales there. Yeah.
And how did you source that one? How did you find that?
Actually, I did a two family in South Boston between the store and the residential unit and the ground up Eastie project. I had a conversion from a single family to a two family on East 5th Street in Southie.
Oh, nice.
That was a great project. I was going to say Joyce, but Tracy Campion's office.
Really? In Southie?
Interestingly, yeah.
Good for them.
Yeah. She had like a younger scrappy kid working for her and he called me about this.
Nice.
So, good deal.
So then you get the one in Eastie. Mm-hmm. And how big was it?
It was a single family on like a good sized lot.
Yeah.
I'm going to say that lot was like 4,000 plus square feet.
Okay.
And I thought that what I was proposing was fairly modest and that it would be taken well. So after having gone through that community process for the very first time back when I was converting the store to a resi unit, after I had finished, I was like, I made some friends at that association and joined. Yeah. They asked me quickly. They were like, we need someone with a little expertise to help, inform this process.
And that's helpful
very
because you're getting
so.
Into a neighborhood where if you're going to build another project, you see yourself building more than one project in that neighborhood.
Yeah.
If you're getting involved in the beginning, that helps you so much. Just get votes on your side and push things along that much easier.
For sure. And you'll learn a ton. Like that's something that costs nothing that I recommend to younger folks who are interested is just start going to your civic association or your neighborhood association meetings, get to know people, watch the process, see what the sticking points are for the neighborhood. And, it's valuable.
Yeah. I've seen developers who they'll develop, three or four projects all on the same street or on like two streets that are next to each other. And you can have neighbors walking down the street and they know everyone. Mm-hmm. They've met everyone over a few years and not everyone likes them, but they know everyone by first name.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's necessary for finding success in this by doing development.
Yeah. Same thing as a realtor.
Yeah.
You don't want to be the realtor like, I'll make an analogy. It's like you drive up a red light next to a construction vehicle that says, we do decks, painting, kitchens, bathrooms, flooring, and roofs. It's like, I'm not going to hire that guy. So same for realtors, same for developers. I think that you want to kind of know an area.
So you do this project, this is your first ground up. Mm-hmm. Is there a huge difference from your point of view on the ground up construction versus a rehab? Is there something that you were not expecting that you learned during the ground up process that took you by surprise maybe?
Yeah, there were some lumps that I took. I had a really good design team with me. I think that helped a lot. There was someone who I'd worked with in my former life who was a big architect, and he had just started his own firm and I was his absolute first client. This is Jason Arndt from Zephyr Architects.
Okay.
Jason since built an awesome firm there. He's super talented.
Yeah.
And so Jason, me being his first client, he gave me a lot of attention. He kind of helped me through things. Mm-hmm. Same goes for structural engineer, group Hazen O'Neill, Jeremiah O'Neill, who continues to be a really good friend. And those guys, I think, helped me avoid some expensive mistakes.
Yeah. And you help, I've noticed that you have a really good attention to detail with finishes. Where does this come from?
It comes from doing one project at a time and having a lot of pride in it. I think a lot of developers, the problem is, and I try to avoid this myself because now that I've been in it, I'm kind of got some gray hairs now. You kind of fall into a trap where it's like you did a recipe, it came out pretty well, and you just sort of rinse and repeat. And ultimately, you end up being that 47-year-old developer who's buying the same tile from Home Depot and the same outdated kitchen cabinet. And
that's how you get those tan tiles that you're stuck
exactly,
with.
Exactly, the almond color subway tiles. Yeah. Screw those. So anyway, I just spend a lot of time on actually Instagram. I was going to say Pinterest, but it's mostly IG.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a developer, but planning out our kitchen, we had, I would start with one kind of idea, color scheme, different finishes. And then I'd be like, well, what if we did, you know, blue instead of black or gray or all black or all white. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden I have five different kitchens and I'm going, I want to build all of these.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what you're doing. You know, yeah. you design maybe a couple of things and you use one on one project. Do you recycle your designs that you didn't use onto the next one?
Yeah, certainly. And even elements of the design might be standard, yeah. You know, trims, crown molding, baseboard, that type of stuff. I might just reuse. And it is nice to have sort of a base template to draw from and you keep, you know, maybe you freshen up the kitchen or our primary bathroom.
Are you consulting with an interior designer at all?
Yeah. And actually really good realtors at this point. It's interesting because I think like some of the better realtors that I work with almost double as interior designers. Have you seen that?
Yeah. There are a couple of colleagues of mine that have renovated their own place and I'm just like, oh, I'm blown away.
Right.
I mean, their kitchens, their living rooms. I have a colleague of mine. She's up in the North Shore. She is an interior designer. That was like her first job.
Yeah.
And then she got into real estate because she said, I can kind of mesh these. And she's been doing real estate for a while. But she designs all of her projects that she works with a couple developers up on the North Shore. And she is the designer for all of them.
Yeah.
So there are definitely realtors that have a great sense of design. There's also plenty of realtors that have a terrible sense of design.
Right.
I'm probably somewhere in the middle.
I'm sure you're getting better. You're doing your own kitchen.
I'm getting better.
This kitchen looks good.
This is the test.
Yeah.
So you do East Boston.
Yeah.
And at what time also do you leave Suffolk? Because you change, right?
Yeah, I did. I spent, like I said, 5 or 6 years at Suffolk. And then there was a development group, New Boston Ventures. Mm-hmm. And they were doing some really exciting stuff in the city. They're based out of the South End. A really great group of guys. And they posted something on LinkedIn that I responded to. And I went and had lunch with the two principals. It was very informal. I just remember someone asking me, like, as before I quit, they're like, do you have an offer letter from the new group? And I was like, no. And I called one of the principals, like, someone told me I should get like a formal offer letter. And he's like, yeah, write whatever you want. Send it to me. I'll sign it. We've never done that.
So you join them.
Just join them.
And they do the Lucas, which is one of my favorite projects in Boston. It's very unique. For people who don't know, it was a old church and you converted it to condos, to residential.
Right.
And you basically kept the facade of the building and built this really cool glass structure that came out the top, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very, very cool.
Is that the first project that you worked on with them or you do anything before that?
Did some stuff before that. That was the first big project.
That one got a lot of press.
It did.
Yeah.
It's still the coolest project I've ever worked on.
It's really cool.
Yeah.
There are some people that I've seen be like, oh, sacrilegious.
Yes. I'm sure we lost buyers.
Which is why I look at that and I go, oh, I would live there.
Yeah. Totally. I heard from people at the time who said, you know, it just creeps me out to live in a church. I won't do it.
I had a showing the other day where it was not a church, but it was a schoolhouse that looked like a church. And he immediately, when we were walking in, I could tell he was like, this is creeping me out.
Yeah.
I said, oh, I think it's pretty cool. But
yeah. To each their own. I mean, we call that adaptive reuse.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I think that the motto or tagline is never ordinary with the New Boston Group. And that's the key to being a successful developer is just sort of uncovering that value wherever it may be. If you take a three family and you put lipstick and rouge on it, you know, keep the same number of bedrooms, refurnish the bed. Sure, there's a modest margin in that for you, but really the skill is in seeing like a single family and saying, wow, I could add on to the back. I could do a pop top with a third level, convert this into a two family, add parking with a curb cut here. And it's that kind of creative way of looking at an opportunity that yields margin.
Yeah. Are you guys, obviously that was such a unique project. Have you guys focused on you guys being that whole company, are they focusing now on trying to find unique projects like that to continue that trend of something different, something new?
Yeah, we just finished a fairly basic ground out 45 unit building in Jamaica Plain. There is nothing, no craziness to it, but we've done.
The numbers worked.
Yeah, numbers worked. We did the Salem Jail prior to the church. Salem
really?
Jail was incredible. It was an old haunted.
I mean, talk about creepy.
Yeah, very much so.
You guys like to stick to those kind of edgy properties that some people will look at and be like, yes. And then some people will be like, absolutely not. No, I will not sleep in that thing.
That's exactly right.
Salem Jail. That's Salem cool. Jail. I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, I'll send you some pictures of that. We've done firehouses. Yeah.
Those are always great.
Yeah.
Big structures, mm-hmm. tall ceilings, beams, any of that stuff, that old factories. I love that stuff.
Yeah. I love stuff that makes a property unique. Like even project that we worked on together in Dorchester, Fort Payne Street, mm-hmm. we had these really cool, gable roofs, mm-hmm. which is, you know, very different from a flat rubber roof.
Yeah.
And instead of, you know, what you might typically do is just finish a flat ceiling. We had allowed the ceiling to follow the gable roof. And in the primary bedrooms, you had these 17-foot vaulted ceilings.
And that was, that property was ground up new construction as well, right?
Yes.
So that was all your architect designing that out with you?
Yes. Yeah. Credit there to Peter Vanko from Vanko Associates, but that was a single family. It was on MLS.
And, really?
Yeah. Wow. It was on for a while. And I think, I think they wanted too much money for it, yeah. For what it was. But I saw it instead of as like a fairly beat up single family. It was on a triple lot that was 120 feet long. And I was like, and next to a park. And I was like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
So I offered the owner, I think, a little bit more than they were even looking for and said, you know, you can have this. I have no financing contingency, but I do need to get my approvals from the city before I'll close. And that was my...
And that was what, a year?
Yeah, COVID came up in the middle of it. So
that doesn't help.
That did not help. Everything stalled for 4 months. Mm. And then there was a huge backlog. But even despite that, it was about a year.
And the seller was okay with that?
Yeah, I think they understood. It was just like the state of the world. What else were they going to...
Yes. Yeah.
But they got everything they wanted and more.
Yeah.
So that was a really cool project and moved in there. We sold our place in Eastie and moved in September.
Yeah.
So.
And now you're working on the project directly behind that building.
Yes.
And was that one that you found during construction? Did you meet the neighbors of that one?
Yes. Yeah. So a woman named Phyllis lives in the single family behind us.
Shout out to Phyllis.
Yeah, Phyllis is great. I spent a lot of time talking to Phyllis. You know, I helped Phyllis shovel the snow in the winter, just kind of built a rapport and a relationship. And there was a property that sold again, like a half a block away that was very similarly sized. And she heard about that and knew the price on it. And mm-hmm. we started talking numbers. I think she wanted to, she's tired of taking care of this house.
Yeah.
So we comped off of that. I said, fine, I'll give you that same price. And, that hopefully will close this spring.
And she's also giving you the full time to get approvals?
Yes.
And you probably, would you say at this point in your career, you won't take on a project without the ability to do that? Or rarely would you do that? I mean, where's your comfort level with that?
You know, I don't like buying unentitled stuff if it only works based on a variance. So yeah. There's a term, it's called a covered land play. And like right now I am under contract on a property. In this little pocket neighborhood of Dorchester called Port Norfolk.
Yeah.
And it's, I'm closing.
Lots of police in that neighborhood. It's weird. That's where our dog sitter, she lives there. And she was like, it is this tiny little neighborhood. It's where all the criminals and all the police, they all just live together in this tiny little area.
Yeah. And firefighters. It's, it's got some really cool parks and waterfront access.
That's really cool. So
7,000 square foot lot with a single family on it. And this one I'm buying and I'm closing at the end of the month. And frankly, it's because it works as a single family. I was competing at that price with some other groups. And I'm pretty sure that I was able to edge out the competition by waiving every contingency.
Yeah. That's your backup is a single family. You know, if they don't give you any sort of approval, you just go full single family. But what are you going for on that one?
I'll defer. There's a couple different options that we're kicking around, and there's a whole process involved. But we'll come back once that thing is
okay. We'll check in a year
further along. Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about because I think that the majority of the audience for this show will be realtors. Mm-hmm. We walk into new construction properties all the time. Mm-hmm. And like we were talking in the beginning, the level of quality is all over the place. Mm-hmm. But you can go, especially if you're on like outside of the city, Dorchester, East Boston, JP, mm-hmm. Somerville, you can have two bedrooms that, $600,000 to $800,000 or $900,000. You'll have similar sized condos that will be priced really closely, but you can tell immediately that the quality is all over the place. Mm-hmm. What is some of your tips or suggestions on, like, without being able to open up the walls, what is something that jumps out to you really easily that other agents would be able to identify quickly as a thing that goes, these people cut corners, this is a hack job, I would stay far away from that?
Sure, sure. Let me think about that. I mean, so I think that there are certain things that are like signals.
Yeah.
And signals are shortcuts. We don't have time or the ability to open every wall and look under every nook and cranny. But to me, some small things like, look at the lighting, you know, every recessed light, you know, probably about $100 by the time it's furnished and installed. And if they're doing some sort of chintzy 1994, flush mount pet light in the center of the living room, instead of some nice dimmable LED lights, I'll put some stock in that as a signal. I might look at other things that are not that expensive and not that hard, but like, did you install a $130 smart thermostat, like an Ecobee or a Nest?
Sure.
Or did you buy like a programmable $26 thermostat from Home Depot?
Sure.
You know, and if it's new construction and you're doing that, it's going to lead me to other questions about what other corners that you may have cut. You know, did you buy washer? Another thing I can't stand is like washer dryer hookups provided. You know, you're doing constantly, all this renovation.
Constantly.
You want this homeowner to manage lugging up and sizing and figuring out which machine's going to work. Just equip the kitchen with appliances and the washer dryer.
That is a huge pet peeve of mine. I put in almost all of my offers for new construction, if they have just the hookups, we always ask for washer and dryer.
Yeah.
And we usually get it because it's just, for the developer, it's easy. They have a relationship with some appliance manufacturer or you know, Yale Appliance or Ferguson. It's not that hard. What, $1,500?
Right.
But it's such a pain in the ass for your first time home buyer that knows nothing. They have to deal with the delivery, the install. They don't know the, you know, if it, what will work, what sizing they need.
Right.
So that kills me.
No. And, you know, if you're a little more sophisticated, I'd say make sure, you know, look at the mechanical equipment, you know, what furnace system, what heating system they're using. You know, could get into a little more technical conversation about that, but in short, I mean, should at least be a tankless hot water heater at this point.
Yeah. What would you say, kind of on the same path, what would you say is like your biggest pet peeve with developments right now that you're seeing?
Biggest pet peeve.
I have a couple.
Yeah.
One is not going to the ceiling with cabinets. Drives me nuts. I see it 9 times out of 10. Yours is one of the only ones I've seen that went to the ceiling. And I don't, ours goes to the ceiling. It's rare, but it just looks corny. It looks cheap when you just kind of cap it off and you have this extra space. I don't know why they don't do that.
I mean, at least frame, we'll soffit or we'll frame down to have that the ceiling sort of meet them. Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm not saying you need cabinets all the way to the top, but just kind of frame it in so it looks like it's all part of the space.
Yeah. Just reminds me of like my grandmother's kitchen. She had a bunch of tchotchkes above the top of the cabinets.
You have these weird, it's just like, it collects dust. Yeah. I had, I mean, we had a buyer who was buying a new construction place in Southie this year, and we redesigned the kitchen. He was, I think, the only person out of 54 units. And he, you know, we were looking at it and he had tall ceilings and he said, I want the soffit to come down and I want the cabinets to go higher. I want to have a whole, he had like, I think 12 foot ceilings or 11 foot ceilings. And we ended up getting a whole third row of cabinets just because it just looked silly.
Yeah.
You know, to spend, you know, 1.2 on a condo and to have cabinets that are just kind of going halfway.
Right.
Just looks cheap to me.
Yeah, I'd agree.
The other thing that I notice, and I don't know, I'm not in construction, so I don't know if this is in my head, but I notice when I walk into, I see this more in gut renovations than in new construction, but either or, when I walk in and the floors feel light and echoey, I feel like noise is going to be a serious issue. It just, when the material feels very light to touch, I don't know if that is a myth that I've made up in my head.
No, but I mean, I think what you're talking about is floating floors. Like oftentimes you'll get a pre-finished engineered hardwood and there's nothing wrong with a pre-finished engineered floor. But if you do use a pre-finished floor, you should either nail through the tongue or glue it down. And otherwise it'll move under your feet and it'll feel, you know, cause floors are not perfect.
Yeah.
You know, a good question to ask is, you know, did the developer install gypcrete? Gypcrete is like a flowable concrete, and it's sort of applied on top of the plywood subfloor, and it really helps with the sound attenuation between units. Challenge is, if you use gypcrete, this concrete, you can't nail into it. So thus you would need to glue mm-hmm. the floors down, and gluing is an expense, yeah. but otherwise you get that kind of hollow feeling.
Yeah. Do you see people do that even on gut renos of like a three unit?
Yeah. You should be. I mean, there's plenty of ways to tackle that. There's a lot of different ways to get there, but that's a pretty effective tried and true approach is gypcrete.
Yeah.
If they're not using that, then they should just tell you, you know, maybe they did something below. They hung the ceiling from spring isolator clips or resilient channel, et cetera. But if they don't, if they stutter around an answer for that, it's a signal.
Yeah. Which you did something like that with Payne Street, right? With the clips?
Yeah. We use this product called Hush Frame.
Yeah.
It's really cool. This guy in Attleboro invented it. It's one of these just like, I wish I thought of this, better mousetrap.
I don't think it was the last episode, maybe it was the last episode on your podcast. You had someone on who talked about noise and sound. That was fascinating. And I recommend anyone check it out.
Thanks, man.
But I think that's probably, if not the most, one of the most overlooked aspects of construction from my point of view is noise and sound. And developers just, especially early developers or people who are cutting corners, they do not care about noise. But it sucks once you, you know, if you're a home buyer, if you're a first time home buyer and you're, you know, you're spending all of your savings, you go in and no one's moved in yet. Mm-hmm. And then everyone moves in at the same time and you're just, you hear everything. Mm-hmm. It ruins it. It's terrible.
Yeah. We brought on an acoustical engineer. Give a quick plug. Our podcast is The Real Estate Addicts.
Great show.
Thanks, man. Yeah. So my friends from HRV Homes, we've got 80 episodes now on any number of topics, but this one was cool. And we talked just about sound attenuation and, you know, happy to go into more of that, but it is a big problem in multifamily residential. And there are some things that are not that difficult to do. But, you know, the other problem is how do you measure, right? Like you're not an acoustical engineer. People ask me all the time, like, Mark, can you, my attorney wants to know if you can provide a detail for your sound attenuation at vertical at party walls. It's like, sure, here's a detail. Do you know how to read it? Do you know what STC 55 means versus 51? So,
but I do think that there's something to be said for the fact that you're either the developer who is taking the time to look into it, or you're the developer who has not.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's all that matters a lot of time.
Yeah.
Because plenty of developers won't even care to look into that. They'll build and they'll just be like, meh, it is what it is.
Yeah. I would say ask the question and hopefully, you know, if someone asks me that question, my eyes light up. It's like, all right, let's talk. I know exactly how I approached that and thought about it. You might not understand every bit that comes back, but I think you could take it as a signal. If someone starts going, you know, I don't know. Let me find out. You know, maybe raise some flags.
Yeah.
Look further.
Yeah. Okay. Let's switch gears. Mm-hmm. I'm a realtor. Mm-hmm. You're a developer. You hear from, I would imagine you hear from real estate agents all the time trying to pitch deals, pitch you properties because they want it on the back end. They want a development. I think that going after developers, it's one of the golden eggs for an agent, right? Because then it just changes your business. Mm-hmm. What is something, so you probably see these all the time. What is something that agents get wrong all the time or people are missing when they give you a pitch on a property?
Basic underwriting. It's amazing to me the number of deals that I'll get that make no sense. And it's like, did you, you know, are you lazy or dumb? Like, I hate to be mean here, but, you know,
and you it can just, be, it's both.
Yeah. I'm not asking you to tell me the the cash on cash return and the IRR of a deal. But like, if it's a if you're pitching it as a condo play, at least just give me like a back of the napkin.
Yeah.
Like here's why I think it makes sense. I plugged in $200 a square foot for construction, but I'm very confident on my sellouts and the acquisition is the acquisition. And, you fill in some of the blanks here, but I think it has the potential to make between. Awesome. But just to like throw me a deal and say like, you do the legwork is kind of lazy.
Do you find that agents who are pitching you deals, are they factoring in holding costs? Are they factoring in, interest? Are they adding that into their spreadsheet at all?
Very, very rarely. And maybe that's not even perhaps my expectation.
Yeah.
There's a course at BU between all of this, I took a certificate in real estate finance, and it's their night classes. And you don't have to take all of them. You don't have to get the certificate, but I'd say like take fundamentals of real estate analysis.
Yeah.
Like know what a cap rate is.
Yeah.
You know, pitching a rental property, at least
do people not know what cap rates are
or how to calculate them. They might know that like, you know, a 3 cap is low and a 9 cap is great. But if you really drilled them on it and said like, How do you get to that?
Right. Or,
you know, can you back into an acquisition price? Your buyer wants to buy a property with nothing below a 7 cap. Can you back into an acquisition price? And, you know, so it's not complicated math, but I'm trying to think what else. Yeah. I mean, just in the body of an email, like, hey, here's the acquisition. I think your construction is probably this. I know that you could get this for the condos if you're to sell it out.
Yeah. You had mentioned 200, but that's not your price per square foot for construction, is it?
It varies.
Yeah.
You know,
cause I've heard anywhere is from like 225 up to 325
for new construction.
Yeah.
That's a decent range.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like saying how long is a string?
so long, short.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many factors, but I always have like a baseline and then I adjust from there. Like, is there going to be an underground garage? Is the soil conditions good? You know, you could go on and on.
Sure. So switching gears again, your show, you do an underrated, overrated, appropriately rated, which is hard to say.
Yeah.
Appropriately rated.
It is.
So I am just curious because you have the attention to detail, you really know the aesthetic of what you're building and you know what looks good. What for you, what do you feel like is one of the, or some of the most underrated things that builders are doing with finishes, like the look, and what's some of the most overrated stuff that you just don't want to see anymore?
Underrated, maybe tile formats and bathrooms.
I think,
you know,
like just the whole design.
Yeah. Like there's a lot that you can do with a herringbone format, chevron, or stack, instead of just a stack bond, turn it vertical, stacked bond where all the grout joints line up. So I think you can take like a fairly middle of the road tile and make it kind of cool.
You had a really cool tile in one of the bathrooms at Payne Street that looked almost wooden.
Yeah.
I love that. That was really cool.
You know, I like to take a little bit of design risk. I think the textbook would say like, just hit the ball down the middle, make clean contact, something that's going to appeal to a broad swath of buyers and that's safe. And that's true. But I always like to take at least one spot in the project where someone's going to walk in and be like, that's super cool. Or, you know, maybe it's not for everyone, but, that was this tile, exactly like you said. It looks exactly like wood, and we used it on the accent walls in this shower.
Yeah, I did. I want to get into that. Yeah. We'll skip to that now because you brought it up. But the risk of pushing limits on design can sometimes backfire significantly.
Yeah.
If you go too bold, you know it looks good for you, but sometimes it's too bold, and you realize you've just limited your buyer pool down to, you know, 5% maybe of what it could have been. Mm-hmm. Are you into taking those risks? Do you feel like developers shouldn't take those risks? Where's your kind of your comfort level with that?
I think they have to be calculated.
Yeah.
You know, I did that in sort of a powder room where I thought it would be a really cool focal piece where all your guests come into and
would you do, let's say you're doing a 6 or an 8 unit building, would you do one unit that is extreme with everything? Or would you do one room or one aspect of the property in all the units?
I would never do one unit different from all the others.
Yeah.
It's just a recipe for disaster, for procurement, and for your mistakes down the line. I don't know, my buddy Ricky from Volney just did a black kitchen in one of his 9 units in East Boston.
That's bold.
I thought that was bold.
And I thought it looked really cool.
Yeah, I did too. I think it took him a little longer to sell it. So, I mean, respect, props for going for it. I'd say again, just my advice there is to be calculated and measured, and you can take some risk, but you can't just go crazy and build something that's super custom.
Okay,
super
so back to, we got the underrated. Mm-hmm. What's your overrated? What are you sick of seeing?
Oh, one more underrated is smart home features.
Yeah.
You know, so inexpensive. Now there's no reason that your property that you finished in 2021 should be the same as the one that was built in 97.
Kind of parallel to smart home. Mm-hmm. Are you running electrical now to your garages?
If I'm not running it, I'm oversizing the panels or I'm making preparations so that it's very easy.
Yeah, we had a buyer who was looking at a development up the street. Mm-hmm. They had not installed the electrical, but we reached out to the developer and he said, oh, I actually ran the lines. Mm-hmm. It is literally right behind the wall. Yeah. You open up the wall, it's there.
Yeah.
So if someone wants to install it, they can. So smart home technology.
Yep.
Is there some cool smart home technology that you're really into these days? You have the faucet.
I'm a total geek. My whole house right now is like totally automated.
Yeah. You have the faucet where you can just say, I want 2 cups of water.
Yeah. Voice IQ, fill my coffee pot and it knows how.
And you're obsessed.
I mean, that's a silly one, but it's fun. I mean, just smart lighting, you know, Alexa, goodbye. Every light in my home turns off.
Yeah.
Change the temperature from,
is that all the lights in your house?
Yeah. Every single light I've done.
Music. Did you do that for the whole building or is that specific to your unit?
I set everyone up with like a baseline.
Yeah.
With some, I certainly can't do dimmers and switches in every room in the house for everybody.
For the cost.
But I'll at least do some lights in the living room and the primary bedroom.
Yeah.
And then they can build off that.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think the smart home tech, the electric car charging ports in the garage, I think all that stuff is necessary for the future. I think it's one way that we can kind of get ahead of not dating the home quickly.
Yeah. I should think that a lot of this stuff should become table stakes. You know, this is a minimum requisite.
Yeah.
But if the smart faucet is the least practical, I think the most practical is a smart lock on your front door.
Yeah.
It's just something that you interface with 2-3 times a day. And when you come home with your hands full of groceries, it's pretty awesome not to have to fumble for keys.
I think of it like powered, windows mm-hmm. on a car, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Like, you know, it might have been a crank.
Yeah.
But like you got to a point where no one had the crank windows, mm-hmm. right? And you don't want to be the home that has the crank windows anymore.
Great example.
You know, you just have to, and it's pretty obvious that that's the direction that we're going. Mm-hmm. And it's not a huge added cost.
Right.
Minimal.
Again, something where a smart lock is now $170 and a typical unit entry lock is like $99.
Right.
So like, why aren't you at least putting a code on it?
Right.
Maybe it's not Bluetooth compatible.
Yeah. So. And the marketability of that is huge. It helps a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Underrated. No, sorry. Overrated.
Overrated. Pot fillers.
Pot fillers.
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
You have a pot filler.
I do. My wife wanted it.
Do you hate it?
Change order. I've never used it.
I mean, you do have
a smart faucet.
You have a faucet right there.
I know.
I get you. The only pot filler I have seen that I was like, that's cool. I could use that was, I saw, I don't know if it was on House or it was on Pinterest, but someone added a dog station at like the end of their kitchen that was mm-hmm. on the ground and it had a tiny miniature pot filler mm-hmm. that you could pull out and fill up the dog bowl.
Yeah,
I mean, it's very extra because you could literally just lift up the dog bowl, which is maybe a couple pounds mm-hmm. and take it to the sink. It's very extra.
Yeah. I think that's a silly one. I don't know. I can go back and forth on radiant floor heat in the primary bathroom.
I like it.
It's nice.
I will say I've never had it. So I'm just assuming I would mm-hmm. like it, but I imagine you get out, especially in the wintertime, mm-hmm. you know, you don't want the cold floors.
Yeah, it's nice.
Do you have that at your place?
I do.
Yeah? And you just don't care for it anymore?
It's not that I don't like it. It's just...
it's overrated.
It's overrated, yeah.
What about color?
You think grays are going out? I feel like gray is
kind of
getting boring. color. Yeah, white and bright. You're never going to lose.
Yeah. How do you feel about, you know, blue cabinets, dark green cabinets? People are doing a lot of the two-tone. Mm-hmm. What's your thoughts on that?
Or gold fixtures.
Gold fixtures, which we're about to do, so don't tell me you hate it.
No, I like it all. Yeah. I don't know. I get the argument that all this stuff is going to scream a certain date at a certain time.
Sure. But there is some stuff, mm-hmm. though, that has been around for like 50, 60 years. And you walk in, you're like, did they do this like 10 years ago? Like, no, it's been 50 or 60 mm-hmm. years. And it holds up.
Yeah.
I mean, there's aspects of it that you can tell quickly. Even with the way that the countertops are sometimes cut mm-hmm. with, I don't know what it's called, but it has that ridge to it sometimes. You're like, this must be from the 70s or 80s.
Sort of an edge profile on the countertop. Yeah. Those kind of ornate ones are cheesy.
Yeah.
I think that like what's nice in a kitchen is if you can use appliances to add a pop of color or something, hardware that's easily, you know, swappable.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Swappable is the key mm-hmm. right there. Cause then if it doesn't work, you swap it out.
Easy enough.
So just to wrap up, mm-hmm. you know, one thing I did want to say is When I brought you a buyer for your property in Dorchester on Payne Street, and one thing that we thought was really cool that I haven't seen anyone do, and maybe I'm just not paying attention, but you documented it, the whole process on Instagram mm-hmm. in depth. Mm-hmm. And you, I don't know if you were advertising that to the buyers, but somehow the buyers found out. And I think all of the buyers or most of the buyers in that project followed you on Instagram and mm-hmm. were following along, which I thought was fascinating because the buyer was able to see behind the walls. They were able to see everything that was going into the property and the project. And it felt like they were very much involved. And it can be a risk to buy pre-construction because you don't know what you're getting, mm-hmm. but you were full transparency with that.
For sure.
Is that something that you were leaning into more and more with your brand, with your development?
Yeah, I think that there's a strong business case. I put my last unit on MLS for 809 and I got a full price offer within like 48 hours.
Yeah.
And it was sight unseen. And I said to the buyer, like, you know, I'm flattered. I'd really like you to come in and see it. Like, yeah. It only works for me if it works for both of us. And he said, Mark, I have seen it. I've been following the whole build on Instagram for the past 9 months.
Yeah.
And at that moment, there was like a light bulb that went off. And I was like, there is a business case for it.
And do you know of any other developers who are doing this?
You know, certainly Dan and Ray from HRV Homes.
Yep.
And Garrett and Max do a pretty good job from On Point Capital. Mm-hmm. But those are the first guys that come to mind who sort of build their own product and bring you behind the scenes.
Yeah. I mean, you were almost daily, which was impressive. And it was just, I think it just puts that anxious feeling at ease. You know, my buyer kept texting me and he'd mm-hmm. just be like, "In Mark, we trust. Like this is good. Like we're just watching, things are looking great." And you're also transparent about when you hit a bump in the road.
Yeah.
And you're not like hiding it, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, here's something that just came up. We have to overcome this. We have to figure out a solution. And then you document through mm-hmm. that solution. So it's, you know that as a buyer, you know that we've kind of come across everything and we haven't left anything behind the scenes here. We're sure. telling everything.
Yeah, that's a good point.
What about TikTok?
Too much. I've tried. It's just too time consuming.
Really?
It takes so much post-production.
Can you not do the same thing on TikTok though?
You can. I just find that like the time that it takes to edit and piece that together is more than I have. And maybe it's because I'm getting those gray hairs now, but you know.
How old are you?
36.
Okay. I have to think about that. Yeah. You're getting up there.
Yeah, I know. Die any day now.
So have you found that the Instagram was that your first time doing like full transparency on a project like that?
No, I've tried to do that.
On your previous ones?
Yeah.
Are you gaining a following?
Yeah, pretty good
of builders and you know, first time developers who are kind of watching what you're doing.
Yeah, I'd say I have almost 4,000 followers and we have a lot of good listeners on the podcast. But you know, I've been doing a lot of development consulting work too. Yeah. And that's been a good forum for that. So guys will approach me if they're gonna GC a project for the first time and they need some advice or help, just you know, how to avoid landmines and tripwires and such.
Is that an angle that you're hoping to kind of get into for an extra part of your business? You know, you started the podcast, mm-hmm. Which is what you've been doing this for 2 years now.
Yeah.
And that is very much, obviously it's discussion, but mm-hmm. you are teaching your listeners. You bring on people who are very specific to a specific part of the construction process or investment part mm-hmm. of the process. And so you're doing a deep dive. It's almost like a masterclass.
Right.
And you talk about you do the Instagram, you're talking about the consulting. Is that something that you're looking into doing, is maybe more on the coaching and teaching side of things with this?
Yeah, I do it because I like it. It's fun, yeah. but it also evens out the cash flows. As a developer, you can imagine there's peaks and valleys and they look pretty extreme on both ends. So it's nice to have some sort of, you know, aside from a few rental properties, a stream of income.
Cool. So to wrap this up, what's next? What is something that you're looking to do? Obviously you can't talk about some of the projects that you're working on, but is there anything that you have coming up that you can talk about that you're excited about?
You know, it is tough. I would love to document more of the zoning and permitting and acquisition process, but you can imagine.
Do they allow you to do that or no?
I'm sure they would allow it. Yeah. It's just probably not in your interest to advertise too broadly.
Sure. who kind of works against you because then you open it up to everyone?
Yeah, there's just certain things where, you know, I'm probably already saying too much, but yeah. At times you might be better off.
That's my business model, is saying too much.
Yeah. I generally do operate that way as well.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, you know, Nick from NS Builders, who's a friend, sort of says like, don't hold all your cards close to your chest, show everyone how you do everything. Yeah. And they'll come to you for how to, when they actually need to execute that.
Yeah.
And you'll announce yourself as the expert. And if you don't, someone else will, because the internet is full of experts and people who are making the YouTube videos and podcasts. So might as well be that guy. Yeah, so don't hold it close to the vest.
I fully respect that. I'm the same way. That's why I'm starting this podcast. And I love to spend time with other agents and helping them, because I know a lot of people who are a very much closed book, but I love to be an open book. Part of the reason is I just love to talk.
Mm-hmm. No,
but I do think it's, you know, you could either be the person who's upfront helping everyone and trying to make change in the business or making moves in the business, or you could be the person who's kind of in the back and trying to be more secretive about things. And that's just not the person who I think I am or who you are.
One of the biggest keys to success for me has just been saying yes.
Yeah.
It's definitely something that came from, I think, at the top at Suffolk. This was like a John Fish mantra. It's just like, what do you need? How can I be of help to you?
Yeah.
Yes. And so someone calls and say like, look, I'm acquiring this building. I just need a sanity check. Yeah, sure. I'll meet you out there. Can I give you a hunt? No, it's cool.
Yeah.
And just do enough small favors for people over time. It's a little Gary V,
yeah.
You know, a little jab, jab, right hook. And you know, it all comes back. Yeah.
Gary's very intense.
Gary V's a longer conversation, but,
he's an acquired taste.
A little bit.
He's not for me.
Yeah.
I know some people who love him. He's just really intense.
I don't love the hustle culture that he espouses. I think that there's too much romanticism around this. Like, if you just grind, you will be successful, because I think it ignores a lot of people who have certain head starts or, you know.
Yeah. Also ignores the fact that maybe I want to just have, you know, take a nap today, put on some sweatpants, watch a movie. Come on.
Yeah.
I can't always be hustling.
No doubt. Yeah.
So where can people find you?
Online, Instagram, choose_Boston. Is probably best on IG, or my website is chooseboston.com.
And the podcast?
Real Estate Addicts Podcast. Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes.
Cool.
All the above.
Mark, thank you, man. Appreciate it.
It's been a blast. Thanks so much for having me on. Yeah.